Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Times are good. Charlotte is booming. There are restaurants everywhere. But last month, an article in the Charlotte Business Journal asked, is Charlotte on the brink of a restaurant recession? That's because some high-profile eateries had closed in the previous several months. Should we regard this as a kind of canary in the coal mine, or as just the normal course of a very tough business in the best of times? We're going to talk about that with several restaurateurs and an industry watcher. Frank Schiabelli is CEO of FS Food Group and owner of several Charlotte restaurants, including Mama Ricotta's, Midwood Smokehouse, and Paco's Tacos and Tequila, also Yafo Kitchen and Plate Perfect Catering. What do you do in your spare time?
Family.
Bonnie Warford is the co-owner of Carpe Diem Restaurant and of Earl's Grocery. Thank you for being here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to see you. And Jennifer Thomas is the person who wrote that provocative sentence I quoted a moment ago. She is a staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Look for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch us this morning on Facebook Live. So let me ask the two restaurant operators here. Does this feel like a restaurant recession to you, Bonnie?
No, I don't think it feels like a recession. I think there's a lot more going on in the restaurants these days that's kind of watered down things and made people a little bit more competitive for the customer. But I think some things are just kind of shaken out. The rents have gone up, and it's a lot to handle.
Frank?
I don't think it's a restaurant recession. I think it's just the restaurant business has always been a business with very thin margins. And I think folks who don't know how to manage the thin margins, I think, are going to be shaken out. And folks who do will continue to thrive. So
what provoked the question, Jennifer?
The fact that we've had so many closings in recent months, and the fact that we've seen just so much increase in terms of competition and costs when it comes to lease rates and those types of things. So it's kind of a situation as to what happens next.
Because later in your article, you say that the current economic environment is in many ways too good to be true for the restaurant industry. And later you quote Bill Deal, who's a partner and broker with Deal Properties, which handles a number of high-profile restaurant leases, as saying it's tough to make it right now. New places opening have to be hurting some of the old standbys. Are we fickle? Is Charlotte fickle? Are diners fickle? Or do they like the old I like the old standbys.
Diners like the old standbys, but at the same time, everybody's anxious to try something new when it comes into the market. And that puts additional pressure on the old standbys that have been here for a long time.
Now, you've got, Frank, several old standby restaurants, and you have some brand new ones. Mm-hmm. And I, as a person who goes out to eat a lot, I will tell you that I like my old standbys because I know what I'm going to get, and they rarely disappoint me. And when they do, I'll give them another shot, and if they do it again, they're off the list. But with a new place, I give them one shot, baby. That's it. If they don't do it, I'm done. Is that how most people face
this? I think a lot of people are like that. I can tell you as a consumer, I'm sort of like that. I would probably give it one shot, and then if maybe, you know, over a period of time, I hear more people say, hey, that's a pretty good place. Maybe I caught it on a bad night, and I'd try it again. But
so as an operator, what do you have? You have to face that because you have your old standby restaurants who have been here for a long time, and you've got new things that you're opening all the time. Which is harder for you?
You know, I think it's the same to me. I mean, I think it's you try to instill a culture in the restaurant, and we tend to, if we have a restaurant that has a good culture mm-hmm. and the GM and the team is clicking, it doesn't matter whether it's an old restaurant or a new restaurant, it sort of plugs along. And then I think if you have teams that get a little dysfunctional and it's not working as well, then maybe you have a little decline in sales and you fix what the problem is. But I don't tend to think it's a I don't really look at it that way, like what's the new one and what's the old one. I sort of, Mama's, for example, Mama's is up 14% this year, which is sort of unbelievable for a 26-year-old restaurant.
And Carpe Diem has been around even longer, right, Bonnie?
Yeah, 29 years.
29, all in various different locations, but 29
Bonnie's a great, Bonnie's a great operator.
Wow. And how do you keep it fresh? Or do they want changes? Do people want changes at a place that's been around for 29 years? Or do they want to come back and see and have exactly what they had before because it was so darned good the last time?
I think they want a little bit of both. I mean, there's things that have been on our menu, like the goat cheese salad for... Mm-hmm. 26 years, I think, something like that, and our fried chicken. So if we took either of those things off the menu and maybe a few others, I think we'd be in trouble. People would be very unhappy. But we try to do new things as well. You have to do both because you have customers who want that and customers who want something completely different.
You mentioned in your article, Jennifer, a couple of restaurants that have closed recently, including Nolan Kitchen on Selwyn and Luca, which actually surprised me. Luca Modern Italian Kitchen uptown, Liberty in South End, Dean and DeLuca, which I didn't consider necessarily a restaurant, but you could eat there and you certainly could take things out from there. It was more of a grocery store to me. And you also mentioned George's Brasserie in South Park, which closed pretty suddenly. They're in Piedmont Row. They closed pretty suddenly. And later in the article, I think you quote George as saying, the owner as saying, that he faced rising lease rates and it didn't make sense in that as the lease rates were going up, he was trying to keep his rent payment at about 7%, I think he said, of total sales. And he was facing having to redo the restaurant anyway to freshen the concept. Why? Why would you have to do that? People came. They liked it.
That restaurant in particular was in a very large footprint, mm-hmm. so it needed to really be revamped to kind of keep up with the times. People came, but as more and more things come into town, it's hard to attract that volume of people he needed to keep things the way they needed to
be. You don't face that at Carpe Diem?
No, not really. I mean, I think people like the comfort of it. I mean, we've also moved three times, so we got the revamp, you know, naturally.
Right.
But no.
Okay. You mentioned in that article, Jennifer, that for every restaurant that closes, another one opens. It's in the wings, at least. That's certainly good news for diners. Is it good news for restaurant operators?
I guess it depends which side you're on. If you're in town and established, I guess it's good because it keeps you at the top of your game because you know you have to continue to be competitive. For people that are looking to come into the market, it creates a new challenge for them as well, in that there's higher rates and there's tighter space. I mean, there's just not as much good space to go around. So you really have to be cautious and careful when you're picking where to go.
I think I read, and I think this was you who said this, Frank, that you like competition.
I love it.
The restaurant business is the most time-consumptive, exhausting business, it would seem to me, because you're there all day. At least people who are actually operating the physical restaurants are there all day, early in the morning. They're doing preparation for, mm-hmm. for the lunch group and the dinner group. Then you're there late at night cleaning up. Then you've got to serve everybody in between, and then you've got to do the business end of it. It has to be exhausting. So why do you want more people coming in aiming at you?
First of all, I think it's – I like the competition. I like the fact that it definitely motivates you. It motivates your team. I also know that, I mean, we've been doing it a long time, and there's a lot of those guys who come in the market with a big splash and don't make it very long, all the time.
Yeah. Well, there have been a couple of restaurants this year. They were open, what, a month?
Yes, we lost Suki Accor after a month over at the embassy.
We've always thought, if you focus on what and doing our job, that we do a great job with what we're supposed to do, we're not really worried about competition.
I concur with that, absolutely.
So just focus on doing what you do and do it to the best of that you can, and that's going to be enough to get
by? I think it is, as long as you are aware of what's going on around you. And I think competition makes areas thrive, brings more people. So their advertising dollar is essentially our advertising dollar.
Kevin on Facebook writes, is the statistic often quoted that only 10% of restaurants stay open past their first year accurate? Does anyone know the answer to that question?
It's what I've heard that, and then I think it drops. I think it's worse after 2 years, something like that. I think it's 10% year one and worse year two.
So when you opened Mama Ricotta's and when you opened Carpe Diem, because Mama Ricotta's is your baby. It's the,
yep.
It's the first restaurant. Yeah, yeah. It's the one that started it all. It was ground zero. Did you think you'd be open this long?
No, absolutely not. I didn't think I'd be open this long. I didn't think I'd be out of the restaurant business. It's been kind of a wild ride. And so, no, didn't anticipate that and didn't, but I've been very fortunate.
Bonnie?
I don't think I thought this far down the road. You know, I think we just opened and we were going to do the best we could. But, you know, second year in for us, we had the Gulf War, which was prior to you opening. That was really difficult to survive. So I think
What happened? Because people were home watching
business,
it on television?
Business just took a complete nosedive. You know, I mean, we would have nights where we did two guests. It was extremely difficult. So that was our first test, I would like to say.
So how would you characterize the industry right now? Today in Charlotte?
I think it's growing really fast. I think we're getting a lot of concepts that we've had in other cities that everybody's been waiting for. And we're doing a lot of things, different kinds of restaurant models, you know, brick and mortar restaurants, food trucks, food halls. So there's a lot to be excited about.
What's a food hall?
Tompkins Hall is actually opening sometime early next year,
it's
I think.
It's going to start rolling openings later this year into next year, and they'll have about 22,000 square feet of food stalls where there are about 600 square feet small restaurants.
But it's in its own facility, and usually it's got some office around it and retail, other retail around it.
Really? Yeah. So it's like
city. Kind of like 7th Street Market.
7th Street Market.
Yeah.
City Fair had steroids. City Fair had something like that. It wasn't very successful, obviously, because it's gone now. But is that a concept that does well in other cities?
It's very mixed. We've looked at it. We looked at it really hard. And I think that's a great project, but it seems like when they're successful, they're crazy successful, and when they're not, they're not.
So what kind of food will they be selling? Is this going to be high-class fast food, essentially? You'd grab something and sit down and eat it? Get your salad here, get your sandwich there, get your drink there. I mean, how does it work?
They're working to come up with a mix of all different restaurants. And for somebody who's looking to tap into the market, who doesn't want to spend that $250, $500 million on a new concept, this is a chance to test something and see if it works.
So Carpe Diem has been an institution in this town for how many years did you say you've been open? 29 years. You started out there on Tryon Street, I believe, South Tryon Street, in what is Radcliffe Florists, which is where I think Bernardin's is now. And you were there for a while, and then they had to build an office tower, so they actually people don't know this, they actually physically pulled out your building and moved it across the street.
They did.
And then they put it back after they finished construction. But you had to move. And then you survived the Elizabeth Avenue streetcar construction. That had to have been horrible.
That was horrible because that was also during the tail end of that the construction was on the tail end of the recession. So not only did we have to survive that business going down, but nobody could get to us, which is when we really started focusing on the catering.
So how do you account for being around 29 years? You've had significant obstacles that would have put many businesses, not just restaurants, out of business.
Well, first of all, I'm in business with my sister, so that's a lot of solidarity, and that helps. And we don't fight. I think we just have a lot of tenacity, and we're really creative financially, which you kind of have to be, especially in the beginning. Yeah. Well, honestly, you have to be that way all the time. I think we're just... I don't know. We're survivors, I guess.
And you've opened so many different concepts, all of which seem to be... It's like everything you touch, Frank, turns to gold.
I've been lucky.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, because you started with an Italian restaurant, which is kind of your roots, your family roots. And then you, I think...
Cantina was second.
Cantina at 1511, and you went through Mexico and much of Central America trying to find authentic foods. We talked about this years ago on this program. Yeah. And what was next for you after that? After you sold
Bad Daddy's was next.
Bad Daddy Burgers, which has also been sold and franchised out.
Yep, Bad Daddy's was next, and then we did Paco's, and then I did Midwood, and then Yaffa.
So I want to come back after the break, and we'll talk about that because this is all over the place.
There's actually, you know, it's logical when I sort of explain it, but you're right.
Okay. Frank Schiavelli is the CEO of FS Food Group. Bonnie Warford is co-owner of Carpe Diem and Earl's Grocery, which we'll also talk about. And Jennifer Thomas is a staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here talking about the state of the restaurant business in Charlotte with two restaurateurs, Frank Schiavelli and Bonnie Warford, and also with an industry watcher, Jennifer Thomas, who writes a lot about this, actually, in the pages of the Charlotte Business Journal. So you opened Mama Ricotta's years ago, and it's still open, and it's still doing well. And then you opened several other restaurants, which you then sold or franchised out and sold the franchises to. And now you have three different things going on, plus a catering service, Frank. And the cuisine started Italian. It went to Mexican. You've done other concepts as well. Why? And here's a great question. Since Mama Ricotta's is so popular and it's been around for so long, why aren't you franchising that?
I would actually do a second unit now, because we've sort of developed a really good team and they'd like to do something else. Uh-huh. And so I would probably do something. And we've looked around a little bit. I'd like to, like, I think Ballantyne area would be great for us. But it's harder to execute in some of the other ones. Like, they're all from scratch, but you're making Mama's, you're making, you know, 150 items, and you're making maybe 50 items at a Midwood. And it's just more complicated to do. It's more moving parts. Mm-hmm. And so... And there's a lot more finesse. Like, we make mozzarella every day, we make sausage every day, we make bread every day. It's hard.
Is there a theme? Not necessarily
food that I like.
Okay,
I mean, literally, it's food that I like, and that I had a. When I first got out of MBA school, I did consulting. We had a client in Texas, so they used to take us to eat really good Mexican food, and then I had Mama's, and I said, oh, you know, there's no good Mexican food here, you know, sort of. So that's how I opened Cantina, and then I have three boys. And I would drive from Mama's to Cantina, and there was a location available, and I'm like, I'd love to do a burger place. My kids love burgers. I think we could do a good spin on it. And that's how I did Bad Daddy's. Mm. And then Yafo was, my college roommate was Persian, and my mom would come and cook Italian food, and his mom would come and cook Persian food. And I really liked it. And so it was just sort of always on my radar.
Hmm. And that's over
Morrison,
yeah.
And then we have Central Avenue's coming shortly, uh-huh, within the next 2 weeks, and then East Boulevard's coming shortly after that.
Now, I want you to respond to this, because as I was reading about you yesterday, there are some people who say, well, Frank's he's an MBA, he's not a chef. But you're the most successful
person. You've been there since the beginning, though. You know, you probably saw me cooking.
I know.
And that's like everybody, it's like, oh, I didn't start in the office. You know, I started cooking it and dishwashing and everything else. You know? Right. And it's just, and we have enough of our team. Everybody knows. I mean, my palate drives what we're doing, period. Yeah. But thankfully, I have an amazing team. We're all on the same page, and that's where we grow. But it's like, it's not accidental that we have good food.
Right. Okay. So, Jennifer, as an observer of restaurants and restaurateurs, you talk to a lot of operators about the challenges they face. We've already mentioned a few among them, increasing competition, rising lease rates, and a tightening labor market. Are these all post-recessionary problems, or have these always been problems that restaurant operators have faced here and around the country?
I think there are always problems restaurateurs have faced. I mean, hiring is always an issue because people don't want to work the schedule where they're away from their friends on the evenings and the weekends and their family. So the hiring piece is really the biggest one of this. Yeah,
that amazes. What you just said amazes me. And I read this yesterday and I thought, what? Because one of the key problems right now is the tightening labor market. Unemployment is pretty low. And so not only is it difficult to find people to work in these restaurants, they want more money. Even the unskilled laborers in the restaurant want more money. And one of the problems I read about yesterday was that many of them don't want to work nights or weekends. Well, you can't be in the restaurant business then, can you?
No.
Why do they even apply? When are they going to work?
Fantasy?
One of our chef's favorite sayings is, this isn't the post office.
So is this a new problem, and does it stem from?
That's a new problem for us. We've never had folks. Or the other thing that happens is they make very good money during the week, and then they don't want to work weekends. I don't know if you get that, but we get a little bit of that now that we never got before.
No, we've never had this problem before. We don't really get that. I think most people expect it, although occasionally we have someone apply who says, oh, and I can't work Fridays or Saturdays.
So is this a problem that stems from so many other job opportunities out there? We don't have to take this job if you don't meet my requirements. I don't need that. I certainly won't meet yours. Or is this a millennial issue?
I don't know the answer to that question. I would hate to offend millennials by saying that. I don't think it's a millennial issue. I think there's just a lot more opportunities, and you can be in the restaurant business and work days, depending on if you wanted to, you could work downtown. I don't know. Frank, what do you think?
Lifestyle's gotten more important. But you know, lifestyle has gotten a lot more important today to today's workforce. Yeah. And that's what I think it is.
Well, that puts you in a difficult situation, because the changing lifestyle is what's bringing more people through your doors. People don't have the time or don't want to cook at home, and they want to go out and have a meal that's worth the money they're paying for. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you need people behind the scenes making that food and serving that food, and that conflicts, because they want the same lifestyle the patrons have. Can that be achieved? Can you have the same lifestyle the patrons have if you're working in the restaurant business?
I don't think so. I mean, you can on a couple days a week, people have always done.
To us, I think you have to appeal to people who are passionate about the business. I think you have people who are doing it for a paycheck, it's going to be a problem. So if you have people who are passionate about food and passionate about hospitality, that's who you have to try to attract.
And isn't that true in any business? Wouldn't it be true in your business, Jennifer? I mean, if you don't like if you don't like facing deadlines, you don't like the fact that you may have to work weekends or holidays, you can't be in the newspaper or the broadcasting business. You simply can't.
No, you can't. There's something happening all the time, and you have to be ready to kind of jump in and take it on.
So restaurants have both skilled and unskilled workers. I guess the skilled workers would be the people who are the chefs and prepare the food, et cetera. And you say that demand, well, the job market is causing you to pay more for both. Many people are under the impression that the waiters don't get paid anything at all except the tips.
Our waiters make a ton of money, and I'm sure your waiters make a ton of money. It's not really anything. We look at it really closely and see what servers make. Our servers make $20 up. You know, $20 would be a lower end for us, and then it's up to $30, $40 an hour. Our servers make fantastic money.
I'll work nights and weekends.
Come on.
and evidently there's been talk among fast food businesses of having to pay what many employees don't get in a fast food restaurant, and that is a living wage. and there's talk of other cities of finding a different form of compensation for waiters other than just through tips. Is that going through the industry here in Charlotte, that conversation?
Not yet. I personally would love that. I don't know that.
Why?
The staff would.
Would the waiters like it?
No, I don't think they would.
Okay.
Some of them would. But I think it would give us an opportunity to offer benefits and some of the things, and more stability in the income instead of having the low season and the high season.
Starbucks is able to offer benefits. How can they do it? And many restaurants,
restaurants. They're the 800-pound gorilla. I mean, they're buying it better. We may actually offer some level. We're looking at it now, doing some level of benefits with our servers. So we're working on that now. But it's challenging.
So as the city grows and more people move here, and more people have moved here, and they continue to move here, I think it's 60 people a day moving in. And one of the things that I'm amazed at is that there are not more restaurants. When you look up and down South End, and you look at some of these apartments going up there and all over town, you would think that those people aren't going to cook a lot. And there would be a lot of different kinds of restaurants in those areas serving those people and everybody else as well. Is that not the case? Because it doesn't seem to be the case.
I think we're getting new restaurants. I mean, I write about an opening or somebody announcing they're coming to town every day. And I think it's a case of having enough space. You've got to wait for the construction to be built out and have space available.
And, of course, as people build out, there are these new spaces probably want more money than an older space would want if you want to put a restaurant or anything else in those places. But there's also the fact that there's declining retail brick and mortar because it's all going to online. So something has to be in those spaces. Wouldn't that equalize the rising rental pressure?
I mean, I think the rental rates all gets back to what they pay for the property and what it costs them to develop it. And then they're backing into a rate of return. So I think that's what's driving whatever the rental rates are. But you're right, there's going to be less retail and there'll be more restaurants. And that's why I think we are in a little bit of a bubble, because I think there'll be a shakeout of folks who, you know, it's a tough business. Not everybody can do it.
Yeah. So what's the biggest pressure, monetarily speaking, on restaurant operators? Is it the food prices? Is it lease prices? Is it just the uncertainty of who's going to show up tonight for dinner? What's the biggest pressure that you face?
I mean, all of those things are challenging. I mean, they all kind of work together. I mean, you know, you have your fixed prices, and then you've got, you know, your labor and your food costs are more flexible. But, you know, you've got things you got to pay no matter how many people come through the door. And you're, when it's slower during the summer, you're paying out close to the same amount that you're paying the rest of the year.
Because you have to order a certain amount. If you have something on the menu, you've got sea bass on the menu, you've got to have sea bass in the kitchen.
Right.
You don't know how much to order. And sea bass, the shelf life of sea bass can't be very long.
No. We get deliveries every day. I mean, we don't get like one delivery a week. I don't. It's a Rubik's Cube of deliveries, basically.
Some of and there's this trend recently in the recent years of let the fire truck go by here. There's a trend recently of food farm to table, and people being very interested in fresh food and where their food comes from, which helps the farmers and it helps the diners and it helps the restaurants in some cases. But now, a lot of our food products go to China. Now there are going to be tariffs on those food products. Will that help or hurt you, do you think? Because if they can't sell the soybeans or whatever it is in China, they have to sell them here. Will the prices go down?
I know certain things, you know, that's, and it's, you're asking in a really broad question.
Yeah.
I know things like pork will probably become cheaper because I know we sell a lot of our pork goes there, but I don't know enough about all of our different items, what's being sold in China. But I think it would probably, you know, help costs in the long term.
Yeah,
I agree. China has, I think, driven up the cost of dairy and meats in the past like 6-7 years. I think
we ship dairy to China.
We do.
Wow, how fast can we do that? We do it on an airplane.
I don't know how fast. Well, we ship seafood from Alaska.
Well, that goes on an airplane. We had got rising food prices, because food prices have been rising, is that right? Rising food prices, rising wages, rising rents. How far can you take the menu prices up to reflect those costs before your customers say, uh-uh?
A lot of the people I talk to say they really can't do that. I had spoken with the Culinary Guild, and they had said that at the end of the day, their customers expect things to be, you know, this price. And if it goes up 50 cents, then they're like, well, why is that going up? They don't understand that it's the cost of food to have it be local. It's the cost for quality. It's the cost for having the best staff.
We don't really, I think it's, we've never changed our business model. We always feel that value needs to be a component, whatever concept we're doing, and that it has to have a good value. And I think that's part of staying power. I feel like you do the same thing. I think you don't have exorbitant prices. You have reasonable prices for what you're offering. And I think as long as you stick to that, people will continue to come to your restaurant. So I think if there's a price change, I think there's a level of trust of they're doing it for a reason.
You've operated restaurants that are, I would call mid-range, high value but mid-range prices to lower range prices. Hamburgers are not.
Well, we were on the top. I mean, yeah. we were $15 a head, $12 to $15 a head for burgers. That's
a
pricey
a lot.
Burger.
Yeah. And you run a fairly high end restaurant. I mean, you don't go to Carpe Diem expecting to get out of there with a $7 entree.
No. You go anywhere?
No, not anymore. Not anymore. So is it more? Are food prices and lease prices, all these prices that you have to pay, are they more critical in a higher-end restaurant than a middle-tier restaurant, or is it the other way around?
I think both.
I think fast food, they're probably, because their check averages are so small.
Yeah.
You know, but I think in our world, food cost is always important. You always want to make sure, as I said at the beginning, it's a business with thin margins. You have to manage your margins. We've gotten a lot better over the years, and we have contracts. We know what prices are coming into our vendors. We know what those costs are. Mm-hmm. And we have enough restaurants that we have some leverage with vendors.
Because the Atlantic Magazine reports that middle-class restaurants, I'm not sure what an example of a middle-class restaurant would be, but they are struggling unless they specialize in breakfast, and that the restaurant story is ultimately about rich city dwellers, I should say, because I guess they have all the expendable income. Do you agree with that? Do we experience that in Charlotte? Is that a problem for middle-class restaurants? They don't serve breakfast, they're done?
I don't think we have that problem yet, but
I guess I'm in trouble and I didn't know it.
Well, I mean, I think that they're, you know, we just serve dinner and we stopped serving lunch when we moved out of downtown. So I think that you start paying rents in places like these major cities.
Yeah. How do you do that? Because the famous toastery is only open for breakfast and lunch, and I'm thinking, how can you afford the rent if you don't serve dinner?
They do a great job, and I know the guy who's the owner, he's a very good operator, and their check average is sneaky high. People end up, you know, a lot of times one of their strategies, a lot of the breakfast places go near hospitals where there's third shifts and people come off third shift and maybe they have a beer with their breakfast or they have, so it's interesting because it's stuff I would have never thought of. Mm-hmm. But there's a market for it. And some of the breakfast concepts coming into town have, you know, $12, $15, $18 check averages, which is not what people think about for breakfast.
Yeah. The National Restaurant Association, Jennifer, reports that every year 60,000 restaurants open around the country, while 50,000 close. That's still a net increase of 10,000 restaurants. How does that compare to what's happening here? How do you scale that down to Charlotte?
I'm not sure how to specifically scale that down to Charlotte, but it certainly seems like we hear a lot more about openings.
We have net growth over year to year?
I would say yes, we do.
So that's a good sign, right?
Yeah.
In 1955, 25% of the average person's food dollar was spent in restaurants. That actually surprises me. That sounds high, because I was alive in 1955, and we could only go to the Hot Shop, which was like Howard Johnson's.
Okay.
Today, 48% of food dollars are spent in restaurants, and for me, that seems low. people are spending more money dining out than in grocery stores. Do you believe that?
I do.
You really?
I think less people cook.
Spending in restaurants has grown twice as fast in the last decade as retail spending on clothes and cars, according to this statistic.
Well, I mean, then throw in DoorDash and Uber Eats and all the other services where, yeah, absolutely. I think that's right on the money.
Is this something that you see continuing into the future, this kind of growth and this shift away from grocery stores toward, and I guess that explains why grocery stores have prepared foods now.
I definitely think it's going to continue because you look at it and people are looking for convenience. They're also looking at it as an entertainment option. So what are we going to do? Well, let's go out to eat. It's become a case where you balance spending for entertainment on, am I going to the movies or I'm going out for dinner and maybe I'll have fancy cocktails or something like that.
So you're in competition not with the restaurants necessarily, but also with movie theaters and other places, people like bowling alleys, places for
breweries.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Frank Schiavelli and Bonnie Warford and Jennifer Thomas in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. For a sexual assault survivor, speaking up about abuse can be daunting. Many never come forward. And for those that do, finding a resolution can be a winding and frustrating road. Charlotte Talks is hosting a special public conversation in partnership with WFAE's podcast, She Says. Join us Thursday evening, August 2nd at 7 at McGlone Theater in Uptown for Beyond, She Says, Sexual Assault in Charlotte. Registration at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the restaurant scene in Charlotte, the challenges they're facing now with the rising rents and rising food prices and shortening a labor shortage, et cetera, and also the good news that we have more dining opportunities around town. Jennifer Thomas is responsible for all this. She's staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal and her recent article about the possible recession of, not recession, what do we call it? I guess it was a recession, a food recession, a restaurant recession in Charlotte. But that provoked our interest in this. Bonnie Warford is here. She's the co-owner of Carpe Diem and Earl's Grocery, which is right down the street on Elizabeth Avenue. Is that right, Elizabeth Avenue?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Frank Schiavelli, CEO of FS Food Group, which owns several different restaurants and has owned even more over the years, Mama Ricotta's, Midwood Smokehouse, Paco's Tacos and Tequila, and Yafo Kitchen, which is about to expand to two additional locations. Earl's Grocery, we just talked about how food opportunities are expanding and people are eating out more and spending less time at the grocery store, but you've opened a grocery store, but it's more than a grocery. It's kind of like a miniature Dean and DeLuca, I would say, wouldn't you say? No?
Very similar, yeah.
Because it's you serve food, you can sit down and eat, Mm-hmm. You can take it out. And you're also catering to people who have a heightened interest in food and who want to do things themselves at home, but they can't find the ingredients for those foods elsewhere.
We have tried to do that. It's a little bit of a moving target.
Yeah.
But mainly what we do, besides having the grill and the coffee bar, is we do a lot of prepared foods. Those three things really drive it. The specialty ingredients, you know, we have some of them, and really people have more of a demand for local things than they do specialty ingredients.
So how would you describe it? What was the concept when you opened the doors?
We wanted to create a place that was casual and would be kind of on the other side of the coin than Carpe Diem, and we wanted to create a place where we felt like there was a sense of community and that just wouldn't have we wanted to do something other than table service and just try something right. completely different. We just wanted to have fun. We wanted something fun.
And you do sell items in there that you take home and use in your own kitchen, but as you say, it's about eating there or taking it out and not necessarily table service. So why call it grocery?
Well, when we first opened, we were doing a lot more grocery items.
Okay.
And we had produce and that kind of thing. And
that's why you say it's a moving target.
Yes. And we had never opened anything before. So, but now, I mean, we still have the specialty ingredients, but we find that people do, they want to come in and buy something already prepared. That's what we were selling most, and that's what we focused on.
And I would think that flexibility is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You opened with a concept. It didn't exactly go the way you thought it might. You made some changes, and now you're rolling with the punches. That you have to do that in the restaurant business, period, right?
Absolutely. I thought Mama's, when I opened it, was going to be way more pizza-focused. I didn't think it was going to be as full-service Italian as it was.
And that's it, as it continues to be.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Let me share with you some comments that have come in while we've been talking from listeners and some questions, too. Andrew on Facebook, as a manager looking to go into ownership soon, I would like to hear what your guests think about the lack of a professional level of front-of-house staff as compared to other major cities. I mean, if you go to New York, for instance, or Chicago, I would think, the waiters that serve you and the front of the maitre d', et cetera, They do this for a living. They've been doing this since they were teenagers, and they're now in their 60s, some of them doing this, and making a good living doing it, too. Do we have that availability in Charlotte? Is that becoming a problem in Charlotte? Are people expecting that now?
I think we have some great staff in Charlotte.
Okay.
I don't know that we have quite the pool that they have in major cities, but I think we're getting to have more of that, and all these high-profile restaurants are drawing more talent to the city as well.
I think, first of all, like it isn't all as it appears. I know operators in New York, they have the same problems we have. They have the same problems attracting good staff, same deal. It's just multiplied. It's a larger city. There's a lot of restaurants. So I don't know that I necessarily agree with the statement about the staff is so much better. You get good people here, you get good people there.
What makes a good waiter? What makes a good person front of house?
Hospitality, period. People who they treat you like you're coming into their house. That's what I think. We talk about it all the time. I think it's the business we're in, and I think that's what people forget.
But, you know, if you go to Ruth's Chris, they don't kneel at your side and say, "Hey, I'm John. I'm going to be your waiter tonight. How you doing?" They don't do that. How do you train your waiters to treat people the way you want them to be treated in your restaurant? Because it differs from place to place, concept to concept, right?
It does, but I think you can get a good sense in interviewing people what their level of courtesy and hospitality is just by how they are in the interview. Mm-hmm. And all those other things are just finer points you have to finesse.
Okay. Kristen emails, "My husband and I have owned restaurants for more than 10 years in Charlotte, and while staffing has always been a challenge, never has it been more difficult than right now in this city. We have kept many faithful employees for those years, but finding good people now is nearly impossible."
100% agree.
100% agree.
Yeah. It's the biggest challenge. And any restaurants where you talk to, it's the same thing. Number one thing is finding good people. We feel like we do an A-plus job of developing our people, but it's getting those people to develop has been a challenge.
And you've heard this from other restaurateurs that you've talked to.
I have. The level of competition for staff has just gone through the roof. People are doing, I mean, it's so competitive that people will say, bring me your W-2 or bring me your paycheck and I'll pay you $1 or $2 more per hour mm-hmm. than somebody else. There's basically stealing of staff going
on. And then
around.
Restaurants, some of the new restaurants, and I'm sure you've heard this, are not opening because they can't staff.
Really?
Yes.
And is that strictly because of the labor shortage, because there's so many other opportunities, unemployment is so low, or is there something else? Is it more lifestyle, like we talked about? I want to work.
I think a new restaurant opening this market is an unknown quantity. I think we actually have more of an advantage in that people know our restaurants, and they know they're successful, and they're going to be busy, and they're going to be able to make a living. And I think new restaurants may or may not be successful. So I think people don't always jump on, in my opinion.
Nicole on Facebook, I was always fine getting night and weekend staff. Keeping daytime people was the hardest, especially finding dependable staff once kids went back to school in the fall. Also true for you guys?
I don't have that.
You don't open on
Well, not at Carpe, yeah. But it's a different, the people at Earl's are different. It's more of a barista, daytime staff, people yeah. going to school, so we don't really have that issue.
So Rose on Twitter is wondering how much the gentrification of the city and rising rents in general has to do with restaurants closing. What have you found as you've talked to people around town, Jennifer?
I think all the closings we've had recently are for different reasons. Sometimes it's health reasons. Sometimes it's just people looking for that next opportunity. I mean, George's Brasserie is a good example. He looked at it and said, I'm going to do something in a smaller space. He's already looking for a new space here for a new smaller concept mm-hmm. that'll probably be Greek focused. He is kind of that example of I'll look at it and I'll shift and evolve and find what's next.
Hector on Facebook, the kids want me to open, his kids, want me to open a Cuban-style restaurant. What is the hardest part of opening up a restaurant? You've done this a lot, Frank. What is the hardest part?
Gosh, that's not an easy question. You know, I think the construction process can be challenging. Getting the restaurant built properly within a budget. I think the lease negotiations are really challenging. I think leases, I've had a lot of people come to me and have signed bad leases and with bad guarantees. And then I think getting a team together and being able to execute your vision is challenging.
It seems to me to be a great gamble to open a restaurant because you don't know, particularly if it's your first restaurant or it's a new concept, because you don't know if people are going to take to it. I don't know how much market research you do before you open a new concept, a restaurant. But you told Jennifer, Frank, that it cost you about $50,000 to $60,000 to open the first Mama Ricotta's, which sat 39 people, and it was over in the Kings Court Shopping Center. Mm-hmm. And then you expanded that mm-hmm. in that shopping center. That cost about $100,000. And then you moved down the street several years later in 2002, and that cost $105,000. And you're about to open a restaurant, or you just opened a new restaurant, and the upfit for that was $1 million.
Yep.
And there's another restaurant opening in town, I think, in Southeast Charlotte. They spent $2 million.
There's one downtown that I've heard 3.2.
Good Lord.
One of the new restaurants, 3.2.
Now, if you're spending that kind of money on part something that may close in a month.
you know, knock on wood, we really haven't had that batting average. We have a pretty good batting average. And so our situation is the reason we spend more is we know we're going to do volume. We know we want certain equipment. Like, for example, at Yafo, we have a tumbler that's a vacuum marinator for the chicken. And that's, you know, a $25,000 piece of equipment. But that makes the chicken better. And so we're going to do what makes the product better. And so we spend money on things. We get this rotisserie from France for the rotisserie at Yafo. And it's, you know, it's a $25,000, that's another $25,000. So it's, you start adding those things up. And when I opened Mama's, it was like, let me find a used stove and a used pizza oven and I'm good to go. Mm. And I think you just can't do that with some of the, if you're trying to do something that's a little better.
Is it the kitchen that's more expensive or is it the front of house?
It's the kitchen. For us, it's the equipment packages have gone up a lot. Hoods have gone up a lot. Hoods have gotten really, you know, all stainless steel work's gotten very expensive.
Yeah. Is it more difficult to open a restaurant than it is to keep it going for 29 years and keep it fresh and keep attracting not only your old standby customers who come all the time, but new people?
I think they're both challenging. I mean, I think sustaining a restaurant probably is harder. there is an excitement opening. You create a buzz. You kind of have that naturally built in. And plus, you have a buzz just by doing it. I mean, I'm in the restaurant business, and we opened Earl's. I mean, it's a blast to open a new place and get excited about it. I mean, so that's kind of what rush that restaurant people get.
How do you spread that excitement? How do you get the word out? I mean, I guess people see something going in someplace as they're driving down the street or they're walking down the street, and at some point it's open. How do you tell people, we're open, here's what we do, here's our price point, come in?
For us, we do a lot of word of mouth. We talk to a lot of friends. We talk to people we know in the media. We do Instagram. We do Facebook less than we used to, mostly Instagram.
Has social media helped or hurt you guys?
I think it helps overall. Reviews are challenging sometimes because you don't get to really reply to those.
I read that there are some doctors and some hospitals in certain cities in America that are now suing people who are leaving negative reviews.
Interesting.
Because it's hurting them, and they say what they're saying is not true. And everybody, you're always going to have disgruntled people, and sometimes with justification. But you guys get hit like everybody gets hit with, I hate this place, one star, no stars, I'll never go back.
I think the the reasonable consumer, I think, just filters those out.
You think?
I think when, yes.
Because the negative,
in my opinion,
the negative ones rise. They're the ones that get the attention.
Yeah, but I don't think it's every. You can take any restaurant in this city. You have your share of one star and bad reviews. What we're looking for, we look for a trend. We look for what are the comments, as a trend. How does that jibe with what our sales are like in that store? Are our sales where they need to be? But I don't think that social media is a huge change. I don't think it's any more powerful. The one thing I find interesting is, food critics, when we opened, food critics were a big deal.
Mm-hmm. There are none.
They are not a big deal anymore.
There are none, because everybody's opinion is equally valid. That's not true, by the way, but that's what everybody thinks.
Absolutely.
Aaron emails a question I was going to ask you anyway, because we're going to get the RNC. The Republican National Convention will be here in 2020. You were both in business during the Democratic National Convention in 2012. What does this mean to restaurants, this convention coming here?
Well, I do think it's a lot of opportunity, especially if you're in the downtown perimeter, if we're doing things the same way. A lot of those restaurants did really well. I think all the hotels and all the restaurants near those hotels are going to do well, too. I'm not so sure that doesn't affect the entire city. During the DNC, we had some catering and things like that, and we had some private room parties, outside of that perimeter.
Because do delegates have a chance to go to restaurants, or do they go and get fed usually at these caucus meetings that they have and at parties that various entities in the political party throw for the delegates from other parts of the world?
I think it's
both.
We had buyouts. We had Tennessee did a lunch at Mama's you just get buyouts and they buy the restaurant out. There's a little bit of that going on.
Okay. Yep.
I think it's good. Overall, I think it's great for the city. The DNC was great for the city. I think the RNC will be great for the city.
Meanwhile, Timothy on Twitter asks about something else I was going to ask about. That's Queen's Feast. Restaurant Week starts in 2 days. Some restaurants do participate, others do not. Is it a good thing for the restaurant industry to have Restaurant Week, where you have special foods on sale, essentially? Or is it a pain in the backside? And is there a payoff down the road? If somebody walks in because they want to try you out because it's Restaurant Week, do they come back?
Sometimes. We've participated in Restaurant Week since the very beginning. And you kind of have to get it down. So you become a volume restaurant and doing the same basically three or four meals for the entire week. But personally, I think it's great for the morale. We get a big punch in the middle of the summer and the winter. And we get new customers. And if we retain 15 of those customers, I'm happy with that.
Okay.
I would agree. It's the same thing. The more you're exposing people to your restaurant, and if you do a really good job, you're going to retain a certain percentage of them. I think there's a certain people who are there just solely for the deal. And I don't think those are our customers. The folks who are there to use it as an incentive to try you. That's who our guests are.
Some quick answers here. Here we go. Does a restaurant owner ever relax? That's from David on Facebook.
No.
No. Rebecca asks, should tipping be abolished?
I think if we could work it out, I would go with tipping being abolished.
I'm a no, and the reason I'm a no is because we ask our servers. I mean, we talk about it with our servers, and I don't think and our team been there making very good money. Our team does not want that.
And Jill emails, how has Bonnie's experience been as a female restaurant owner? My favorite restaurant in town is Dish, owned by a woman, but I don't know of any others. Can you recommend a female-owned or managed restaurant that we can support very quickly?
Fran's Filling Station, 300
my
East.
Sister.
Yeah. It's your sister.
And 300 East has been around longer than we have.
Yeah.
Okay. That's Bonnie Warford, owner of Carpe Diem and Earl's Grocery, Frank Schiavelli from FS Food Groups, and Jennifer Thomas from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.